with not being recognized at this point, because as long as the photographs are still around and they're circulated or deposited, let's say in the Library of Congress, researchers will start looking.
At this stage of my life,
I'm happy with it. I can leave something for future generations.
Yes, the words of Corky Lee, and we just have about 15 seconds. Professor Nye, you co-edited this book. What do you want people to take away from it?
Well, when we lost Corky to COVID, it was a tremendous loss for the community. You know,
he was filming Chinatown during COVID.
He did. And he always wore a mask, but that wasn't, you know, this was before we had vaccines. It was a great loss. But we hope this book will honor him and his legacy.
We have to leave it there. May Nye, co-editor of Corky Lee's Asian America, 50 Years of Photographic Justice.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new survey shows Oregonians are worried about the ever higher cost of healthcare. Portland City Council will vote on buying a new supply of so-called less lethal munitions for Portland police. And in national news, former President Trump's hush money trial heads towards jury deliberation. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 28, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. A new survey shows Oregonians are feeling the pressure of sky-high health care prices. The Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG, released their analysis today. They found that while a majority of Oregonians have some kind of health insurance, three-quarters of them are still worried about high health care costs. 43% of Oregonians are underinsured, meaning they don't have adequate health care coverage. Over a third say they've delayed or canceled medical treatments because the care they needed wasn't covered by their insurance. This comes as state lawmakers are poised to host a number of healthcare hearings in Salem later this week, including on hospital finances and billings. Charlie Fisher is the state director for OSPIRG. He said, quote, "This survey just confirms what we already know. Healthcare continues to cost too much and deliver too little for Oregonians. In particular, lawmakers should look at hospital prices and billing when they think about how to bring down healthcare costs overall," end quote. The survey also found that nearly three-quarters of Oregonians believe that lawmakers should take action to reduce hospital prices. A new report on Oregon's workforce finds the state is in a good position for growth. But as Eric Tegedoff reports, the state needs to address some gaps to keep the growth going.
A new report analyzes the workforce dynamics in Oregon and how the state can address gaps for workers and industries.
The 2024 talent assessment finds that Oregon's economy is in a strong position, with significant growth in the labor market and more growth anticipated in the future. Christiana McFarland is with SRI, the firm that conducted the assessment. She says there are some factors that could be barriers to achieving that future growth.
We know that jobs are projected to grow, but we know that the population and population growth is relatively stagnant. So that's going to be a challenge into the future, particularly for occupations and industries that have a really high demand for workers in the state, particularly healthcare and childcare.
The assessment was conducted for the Workforce and Talent Development Board and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for the state of Oregon. The report offers industry-level recommendations. McFarland says employees in the healthcare field need more on-the-job training. Same with semiconductor manufacturing, which is ramping up in Oregon. McFarland says this work is actually closely related to IT work, and that's important to keep in mind so people in the state are well-positioned for these jobs.
It's critical for semiconductor manufacturing programs to include coding and programming as the core part of their curriculum.
McFarland says rural Oregon could be another asset for the state when considering how it closes employment gaps in semiconductor manufacturing and other industries.
Where are workers coming from? Whether it's a matter of attracting talent from out of the state or thinking about who is underserved within the state, namely rural communities, and how can rural communities and rural students better understand the opportunities that are available to them within the state.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
On Wednesday, May 29th, the Portland City Council will consider an ordinance that would give over $1 million to the Portland Police Bureau for crowd control training and munitions. Item 445 on this week's agenda specifically authorizes the purchase of so-called public order shields and crowd control munitions, but does not specify what kind of munitions these will be. The previous incarnation of the Police Bureau team charged with public order, the Rapid Response Team, or RRT, voted to disband in June of 2021. That was after one of them, Officer Corey Budworth, was indicted for a fourth-degree assault for striking a protester with his baton in 2020. This was just one instance of the city and police facing lawsuits stemming from the 2020 protests. The city paid out nearly $750,000 in related settlements last year alone, and $264,000 already in 2024. The current ordinance language does not reference the mass resignation, instead characterizing the end of the RRT as a dissolution or hiatus without giving any reason for it. Earlier this year, City Council approved incentives to recruit a new crowd control unit in anticipation of a tumultuous election year. The new unit has already been deployed several times to violently suppress student-led protests at PSU since April. During the RRT's so-called hiatus, the city did not replenish its crowd control munitions inventory according to the ordinance. Since riot shields and munitions are federally controlled items, their purchase must be approved by City Council, and the agenda item will be open for public comment. President Biden delivers a Memorial Day address. Former President Trump's hush money trial is poised for jury deliberations, and the Justice Department warns of threats to election officials. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Freedom has never been guaranteed. Every generation has to earn it, fight for it, defend it in battle between autocracy and democracy, between the greed of a few and the rights of many.
President Joe Biden in his Memorial Day address at Arlington National Cemetery. This week also marks the 9th anniversary of the death of the president's son, Beau, from what may have been a service-related case of brain cancer. Speaking to families who've lost members, Biden said the pain they share is a raw presence every day, as is pride. Nodding to the campaign, Biden noted that he signed more than 30 bipartisan laws aimed at supporting troops and vets. In stark contrast, former President Donald Trump posted an angry message on Truth Social, writing Happy Memorial Day to all, including the human scum that is working so hard to destroy our once great country. Trump spoke at the Libertarian Party's National Convention Saturday, a day after anti-vaccine activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Trump's name was not formally submitted for presidential nomination, which went to a Georgia HR executive. But Trump said the party would have been wise to nominate him.
The Libertarian Party should nominate Trump for President of the United States.
Only if you want to win. Only if you want to win. Maybe you don't want to win.
Trump critic and former FBI Director James Comey tells CNN there is a chance of a hung jury in Trump's hush money trial. But Comey says he thinks the case set to the jury is very strong.
It's an 80% chance of conviction given the case they put together. It's based on documents and texts and emails and the words of the defendant.
Comey says he's one of many worrying about violence towards poll workers and election officials. Attorney General Merrick Garland last week cited a dangerous increase in threats, which he said wouldn't be taken lightly.
If you threaten to harm or kill an election worker, the Justice Department will find you. The public servants who administer our elections must be able to do their jobs without fearing for their safety.
Nearly 70 million people were under severe weather warnings on Memorial Day as storms turned northeast after killing more than 20 and disrupting power across the plains. Governor Greg Abbott declared a disaster in more than a third of Texas counties.
We estimate there being close to 100 people who were injured. More than 200 homes and structures were listed as destroyed. Another more than 120 were listed as damaged.
Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear also declared a state of emergency there, and the storms are snarling flights across much of the east and south. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Native residents who are unhoused in Rapid City, South Dakota, stand to benefit from new programs to help them find housing. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Statistics show homelessness in South Dakota may be down overall, but the state's urban areas are an exception. New programs in Sioux Falls aims to address it. More from Kathleen Shannon.
The most recent point in time data show the number of people unhoused in Sioux Falls rose by 20% between 2022 and 2023. Native people experience homelessness at a disproportionately high rate, making up nearly 40% of the unhoused population in the area. So, South Dakota Urban Indian Health launched the WOKEA program last year with case management services and help making and getting to medical appointments. Program manager and Standing Rock Sioux Tribe member Monica Bailey says these wraparound services give staff a variety of options to respond.
They want to go to treatment or if they want to talk. We also provide smudging, therapeutic beating and sewing. We just meet people where they're at on their journey.
Bailey says the organization is averaging 1,300 contacts a month, an increase from about 260 last September after launching its initial street outreach efforts a year ago. The city of Sioux Falls also hired its first homelessness services coordinator in April. Bailey says WOKEA will work closely with the coordinator and has partnered with others in the city.
For example, we have a great relationship with downtown Sioux Falls Library, where they can call us and we can go in and check on someone and bring them to our space or see if we need to do a warm handoff.
The unhoused population in Rapid City also grew last year, although homelessness across the state has decreased nearly 8% since 2022, according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
That was Kathleen Shannon reporting. The National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition has launched the National Indian Boarding School Digital Archive, which is a database on Indian boarding schools. Its aim is to preserve and bring to light the history of U.S. Indian boarding schools. Over the last 4 years, the coalition has been compiling and digitizing records from Indian boarding schools. According to the coalition, through the database, survivors, families, researchers, educators, tribal leaders, and the public will have access to information that allows them to gain a better understanding of what happened at Indian boarding schools. The digital repository includes documents, photographs, and oral histories, which will offer insights into the experiences of those who attended the institutions and the impact they've had on Native communities. Deborah Parker, the coalition's CEO, says the initiative marks a significant milestone in their commitment to truth, healing, and justice. She says the majority of all Indian boarding school records are currently not available to the public, and that by making these records accessible, they're taking a big step towards honoring the history and strength of Native peoples. Their research has identified 523 Indian boarding schools across the U.S. Information and access to the digital archives can be found online at boardingschoolhealing.org. Red Lake Nation College is celebrating its grand opening of its Minneapolis, Minnesota site. The new campus is located in downtown Minneapolis. According to the college, its intent is to fill a void in higher education by offering affordable higher education grounded in Ojibwe language and culture to Native students in the heart of Minneapolis. The college is an accredited two-year tribal college located on the Red Lake Nation in northern Minnesota. It's delivered courses through distance learning to downtown Minneapolis students since 2021. The new site, completed in the spring of 2024, will provide state-of-the-art facilities and education services to support Native students. Dan King, president of the college, says the grand opening represents a significant step towards providing accessible education to Native American communities living in urban areas. He says by establishing the Minneapolis location, they're pioneering a new era of tribal college presence in major metropolitan centers, preparing students for success in the job market. The grand opening will take place on June 6th. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. Emma Lugo interviews Rachel Evans from the Oregon Jewish Community Foundation about work they're doing to support organizations that support houseless Oregonians. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, EcoJustice Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds continue with a daytime high of 65. Today in history, in 2014, American poet and civil rights activist Maya Angelou passed away at the age of 86. The quote of the day is from Angelou, who said, quote, "Without courage, we cannot practice any other virtue with consistency. We can't be kind, true, merciful, generous, or honest." Across the nation, 70% of parents say they're now more concerned about their child's mental health than physical health, according to a new survey by CVS Health Morning Consult. Nadia Ramlagan reports.
Associate Vice President and Deputy Chief Psychiatric Officer for CVS Health, Dr. Deborah Fernandez-Turner, says young people are facing numerous challenges that are leading to climbing rates of depression, anxiety, and thoughts of suicide. She says there are resources available to help both adults and kids, including online depression screenings.
If somebody is struggling and needing support, some of the best things to do is to work with your primary care doctor, or remember to work with your employee assistance program. It is really a great way to get support. And the earlier you seek treatment and the earlier you seek support, the easier it's going to be to get that support.
According to the survey, more than a third of adults have started to turn off notifications for social media apps and are attempting to spend less time on social media. Nadia Ramlagan reporting.
A new documentary series explores medical aid in dying, which is legal in just 10 states, including Oregon. Suzanne Potter has the story.
A new documentary series looks at medical aid in dying through the eyes of terminally ill people advocating for a peaceful passing on their own terms. The show, Take Me Out Feet First, just debuted on Amazon Prime. In the first episode, director Serene Michelle Dillman follows her mother's journey and then her father's 5 years later as they chose to pass away at home in the Bay Area, surrounded by friends and family.
My father said, if people of sound mind want to take this route out of life, they should have the right. Anytime somebody avoids pain and suffering, how can you argue with that? If this is a legal vehicle to do that, why would you want to take it away?
Medical aid in dying is legal in California, 9 other states, and Washington, D.C. Advocates are working to pass it in the remaining 40 states. Other episodes follow other patients, including a man who started a podcast to document his battle with a terminal illness. The series was produced in partnership with the nonprofit Compassion and Choices. CEO Kim Callanan says the families featured in the show approached end-of-life care with dignity and grace.
It really balances the heaviness of this topic with moments of genuine warmth and inspiration that demonstrates that this law is really about bringing humanity to the end of life, and that's what so many people desperately want this option in their state.
The California End of Life Option Act took effect in 2016. It allows a terminally ill adult with less than 6 months to live to request a prescription to self-ingest and peacefully end their suffering if they choose to take it. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Workers at an assisted living facility for a company based in Seattle are looking for higher wages in their union contract negotiations. They say they deserve more for the work that they do. Eric Tagadoff has more.
Workers for an assisted living facility are calling for higher wages in their union contract negotiations. Aegis Living is a Seattle-based company that has been in negotiations with SEIU 775 workers since March 2023. Workers say higher pay would help with retention. Grinesh Chetty is a medications manager at Aegis Ravina in Seattle and says workers who stick around are able to build a bond and trust the residents they serve.
But if you have staff that are leaving, then the residents feel like there's always someone new coming to tell them what to do, and they don't really know the residents, and that creates a conflict. So it makes their life more stressful.
SEIU 775 says Aegis Living has increased fees for residents, but that money has not made its way to workers. A spokesperson for Aegis Living says its objective is to foster a strong and unified team environment and that it's proud of its 2,700 employees serving 2,500 residents. Negotiations are scheduled to continue this week with a mediator. Chetty says some of his colleagues are leaving for minimum wage jobs because the pay is similar and the work is less stressful.
With resident care, you have to be on top of everything. If they're not feeling well, if they're getting sick, you have to let the nurses know so you can get them to the hospital. You have to make sure they take their meds on time. You have to make sure they're showered. You have to make sure they're safe. They don't have anything dangerous with them. So it's a very risky job.
In 2021, Aegis settled a $16 million class action lawsuit with Washington and California residents who claimed the company was misleading about staffing levels and violated consumer protection and elder abuse laws. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Opioid overdoses and addiction to fentanyl is a nationwide crisis. The latest report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows opioid drug overdoses in Indiana decreased by almost 18% between December 2022 and 2023. But the Indiana Department of Health has concerns that other drugs on the horizon will lead to even more deaths. One nonprofit hopes to help by distributing the overdose reversal drug naloxone. Terry D. has more on the results and advocacy in Indianapolis.
Drug overdoses are decreasing in Indiana. The data is encouraging, but too late for one mother who lost her son to a heroin overdose. The Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention say the state saw a nearly 18% drop in drug use over a one-year span starting in December 2022. Founder of the nonprofit Overdose Lifeline, Justin Phillips, says she channeled her pain towards one of advocacy, education, and support for others affected by addiction.
I learned that hydrocodone and heroin were the same drug with different chemical makeup, and all of this stuff that I, as a fairly educated person, didn't know. So I knew I had to do something with my grief and loss.
A 2021 Indiana Department of Health report shows opioid as the most frequently found substance in overdose deaths. Public health officials warn fatalities will rise linked to non-opioid substances such as cocaine, benzodiazepines, and amphetamines. Removing the stigma, shame, and misunderstanding behind substance abuse associated with opioid use disorder is another objective of Overdose Lifeline. Phillips' efforts led to lawmakers passing Aaron's Law in 2015, named after her late son. But she would like to see more legislative action behind stopping the criminalization of syringe possession and clarity of fentanyl test strip coding.
Individuals with substance use disorder use syringes. We need to help individuals, not punish them. Secondly, we would like to clear up the language so that people don't feel afraid to use a fentanyl test strip and be able to test their drugs before they use them without fear of criminal punishment.
She admits most people are not willing to accept that substance abuse is a chronic disease and that people need help, not judgment. The National Center for Health Statistics reports in 2022, 43 per 100,000 Hoosiers died from a drug overdose. This is Terry D. for Indiana News Service.
U.S.-China relations have stabilized, Beijing says. And the U.S. agrees that on some issues, notably military-to-military talks, progress has been made. But several other long-standing differences remain, notably on Taiwan's status. China says their main challenge is for the U.S. to accept that partnership, not rivalry, defines relations. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. 6 months after the summit meeting in San Francisco between President Biden and China's President Xi Jinping, where do things stand? On the surface, it would appear that many of the same issues that have caused disputes remain unresolved, such as Taiwan's status. Meantime, new disputes have come along, such as in the South China Sea. Yet there are some positives, starting with the resumption of regular high-level contact between top officials. As a result, China's leaders have concluded that the relationship has stabilized. Foreign Minister Wang Yi set the tone in a speech in January. Quote, "After strenuous efforts, the two sides have restructured communication and dialogue, stemming the decline and stabilizing bilateral ties." Wang praised Biden's commitments on Taiwan policy and on not seeking, quote, "to suppress and contain China's development." "The two sides reached consensus," said Wang, "on more than 20 achievements, restored and established a series of dialogue and communication mechanisms, and formed a future-oriented San Francisco vision," unquote. Xi Jinping has pointed to the positive direction of relations a number of times since. For example, when he met with U.S. business executives in March, he said that since the San Francisco meeting, the two sides had made progress in several areas, and as a result, quote, "China and the United States have more, not fewer, common interests." Both presidents, moreover, are in agreement on a number of points that may lead to more positive achievements. They agree that the U.S.-China relationship must be managed responsibly, that the worst thing that can happen is a war between them, and that the two countries have a global obligation to find ways to work together. At the San Francisco summit, Biden and Xi identified three common projects: stopping fentanyl precursor production in China, working on climate change, and resuming military-to-military meetings. Xi also agreed that China would not interfere in the U.S. elections. How did those agreements work out? In a nutshell, the results are these. On fentanyl, Xi agreed to target Chinese companies and block their accounts. A working group was established to coordinate counter-narcotics issues. In February, U.S. and Chinese officials met and agreed to review the problem. Second, Xi and Biden also reached agreement to, quote, "pursue efforts to triple renewable energy capacity globally by 2030. And on military talks, four meetings have occurred since San Francisco, including one between defense secretaries for the first time since November 2022. A working group has met on maritime military concerns, reportedly with good results. As for China's promise not to interfere in U.S. elections, the U.S. charges that it has not kept that promise. In addition, on the negative side, there continues to be disagreement on a wide range of issues: Taiwan, U.S. security policy in Asia, trade, human rights, and China's support of Russia's aggression in Ukraine. At first glance, therefore, it might appear that the negatives outweigh the positives. But I think otherwise, especially when we recall how bad relations were only a year or so ago. Both countries are being very careful not to let flashpoints, such as Taiwan and the South China Sea, spill over into actual conflict. Stabilized relations are an improvement over unpredictable relations. However, it must also be said that the U.S. and China often speak past one another. Whereas U.S. leaders and diplomats want to focus only on specific issues, the Chinese insist that the U.S. accept certain principles, primary among them, partnership, not rivalry. Here we have a fundamental collision of views. The U.S. portrayal of China as the number one threat to national security versus China's belief that the U.S. is wedded to Cold War zero-sum thinking instead of focusing on cooperation. At bottom, what the Chinese really want and what the U.S. will not give them is agreement not to interfere in what the Chinese regard as internal matters, a red line that includes Taiwan, human rights, and economic development strategy. One way for the U.S. to break the ice would be to drop the idea of permanent rivalry and challenge the People's Republic of China to demonstrate partnership on Ukraine while the U.S. demonstrates that its aid to Taiwan is not in support of Taiwan independence. See if a different U.S. approach to China will decrease Chinese support of Russia in the war and reduce hostility toward Taiwan. Failure to come to grips with the question of how to characterize the relationship as partnership or rivalry means that friction will go on for a long time, cooperation on particular issues will be spotty, and conflict management, not conflict resolution, will be essential to keep the pot from boiling over. I'm Mel Gertov for the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 28, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Emma Lugo, Sam Bowman, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, and Terry D. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. Today we're here with Rachel Evans, and my name is Emma Lugo, and we're going to be talking about a program that Rachel's working on that supports the houseless and people without homes community here in Portland, and talking a little bit more about homelessness and kind of what's going on to support those folks. So Rachel, welcome to KBOO Community Radio.
Thanks, Emma. Appreciate it.
Thanks. So, Rachel, tell me a little bit about yourself and tell me about this program that you work with.
Thanks, Emma. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. Yes, I'm Rachel Evans, and I work at the Oregon Jewish Community Foundation. And our mission is to promote a culture of giving in Oregon and Southwest Washington that creates a thriving Jewish community, but also a thriving secular community.